Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Morning and welcome back to Greenwashed. You're with Jaspreet and Don, and here with us today we have Catherine Moody, an ex-Massey University lecturer and a planning consultant. Catherine has a degree, a bachelor's degree from the States before you moved to New Zealand quite a few decades ago now, Catherine. And yes, you've maintained a keen interest in computers, telecom. You've managed your spectrums, and this is something that I have no idea of, broadband and internet spectrums. So you've certainly are an IT geek. But along with it, from Massey, you got your postgraduate diploma in planning and environment. And Don and I are very happy to have you on Greenwashed today. Welcome.
Lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, we have had exposure to a lot of your content over the last couple of years, Catherine, especially with regards to the RCP 8.5 issues that you've written about, because Don and I and our listeners here have been exposed to a lot of what's been happening at the Kapiti Coast and the impact that using of improbable scenarios has had on people's houses and people's lives, literally, on the Kapiti Coast. And that is something we want to bring forth again into people's memories, because this new government, the coalition, the way I see it, they are carrying on the work of the last government, which had sort of initiated an inquiry into a national coastal adaptation plan, a program. And earlier, a couple of months back, the new government has now pushed forth with an inquiry again for a national coastal adaptation plan. And seeing all that has happened in the Kapiti Coast, we have had people like Salima here from the Kapiti Ratepayers United and others, seeing that how the planning process was deeply flawed there, I can't but be apprehensive that are we now going to see a repeat of that up and down New Zealand? Am I being too critical here?
No. No. Frankly, where the new government is concerned, I mean, I've read the Labour governments under James Shaw from the Green Party, that national plan, that national adaptation plan. And there's nothing wrong with having a national adaptation plan. One of the actions that needed to be undertaken in that plan, which is a stated action, is that very few councils around New Zealand have actually implemented the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement. 2010, it was written. And the law, that is the law in terms of coastal management, it's good law, very good law, and it doesn't support this kind of alarmist type of reaction to climate change or sea level rise by any means. In fact, it's a very sensible approach to how one should look at and manage their coasts. The actual clause in the legislation, the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement, which is a national policy statement. So in terms of the RMA, you have the act itself, and then you have subordinate legislation. So the NZCPS 2010 is the subordinate legislation on how to manage the coast. And the policy of concern is policy 24 in the NZCPS, which is the identification of coastal hazards. How to identify them. This has been a real failure of the consulting sector in New Zealand, because councils don't have the ability to actually identify coastal hazards. It's a very scientific activity. They go to consultancy firms, and consultancy firms, and I think I said it in one of my articles on interest.co, there's a lot of money in this, a great deal of money in this. The Kapiti Coast spent $5 million on their recent adaptation planning exercise, which is just ridiculous for a small council. Unbelievable. And most of that money went to consultants So the consultants love the idea that this wicked problem that never ends just keeps going.
Mm.
You know, that we can never say that really sea level rise hasn't done the hockey stick yet. It's going to happen. You know, in other words, this idea of, what did you say your council's talking about? 3 meters worth of
Sea level rises.
That's a fantasy. It's voodoo science. Even the IPCC aren't saying that. And we are noticing now that finally much of academia is walking it back, you know, walking back the idea that climate change and sea level rise in particular, because we know that storms are stormy. You know, we know that rain will probably, as a result of anthropogenic emissions, it will probably be heavier, faster, quicker, you know. But where climate change and the coast are concerned, the main and almost only factor affecting the coast is sea level rise. So why we are overemphasizing the issue of sea level rise, as I said to my students, no one ever died of sea level rise, but people are dying of these storms that we need to manage better, of the fact that the debris that comes down the rivers after a storm can take away houses and lives. Yet we're spending $5 million in the Caprivi Coast on sea level rise, which never killed anyone yet. So we really have to, and this government, they need to just tell the people of New Zealand, this is not our major problem. Our coasts have always eroded. They are going to continue to erode. Other coasts like Farewell Spit are growing. We have both accreting and eroding coastlines, and we've dealt with them in the past and will continue to deal with them in the future. Let's get down to other issues that matter, because this one, frankly, doesn't in the greater scheme of things.
In the greater scheme of things, of course, we've had civilizations have to move because of their changing environment. They move to build their own resilience. And secondly, in New Zealand, as I understand it, and I've listened to output likes of yours, and I've listened to Sean Rush and others that you've worked with, and of course, we've got the movement of our plates. We can actually have a rising land versus the sea some days, and it can happen in minutes.
Not millennia,
can happen in minutes.
As it did in Kaikoura.
Yep, with the earthquake. Yep. And so overnight, you had land move up massive amounts, and what do you do?
Yeah.
You can't sort of plan for that sort of land movement, vertical land movement in Kaikoura, and yet there it was.
That's right. It really is frustrating as a planner, because planners are spending a lot of time on this particular issue when there are many other issues that I'm sure they would rather be talking about.
Yeah.
That aren't. I mean, these days, if you're not involved in climate change, you haven't got anywhere near the prospects of a future career that you do. If you, it's crazy. It's ridiculous.
Well, I used to have this saying, Catherine, that climate change was the greatest job scheme ever devised for the world. And maybe I'm a bit cynical about it. And the other thing I've noticed is, I'm not one to read big documents, so I'm not going to be like Jasper Eat and read 2,500 pages of an AR6, but I have read summary documents. And what I've noted is that it's very, I think you're right. I think the IPCC reports, if you read the small print effectively, so every word, they are telling more truth than mistruths. But the summary for policymakers and the stuff that hits the media is never quite what it seems if they read the reports. And that's the inconvenient truths coming to the surface. They're untruths, actually.
That's right. So in fact, there's a lot of controversy inside the IPCC about the way in which these summaries are being presented. The cherry picking on in terms of the writing. So the summary for policymakers is more of a policy statement than a scientific one.
Yeah. And I was looking, and you know, Dawn has said that I read 2,500 pages, so I'll show off a bit. And I did read the last AR6 one, and they spoke about climatic impact drivers and how much of the various natural weather phenomena have we found a signal for. So you were talking about rain and that it's going to get heavier. So for mean precipitation, IPCC found a signal that it might be getting a bit heavier by 2050 under at least RCP 8.5, SSP 5, 8.5. So if it was below that, they are not finding those sort of signals, and yet here we are, pushing our developers and builders to account for stormwater pipes for this much overflow and XYZ amounts. And who pays the cost for all of those scenarios that these magic crystal balls planners seem to have? Us?
I remember when I was involved with the Cape Coast District Council many years ago, before I actually trained in planning, they were talking about flooding problems on the coast, and it was lack of stormwater infrastructure. You know, what you do tend to do in planning is you build on the best land first, and then you fill in the hollows, and the hollows are at a lower, you know, they're the dips in the land, and they're going to flood. And I remember a consulting firm telling the mayor in a meeting I was in, you're going to have to designate certain land as being off limits for building. So like no-go zones. You know, you can't build on this land because regardless of what you do to attempt to mitigate, it's still going to flood. If it floods in the pre-development stage, it will flood in the post-development stage. And that's what's happened everywhere in New Zealand. We've built on that land, which was less suitable for urban development, and we don't want to pay the cost of that. We don't want to actually put the stormwater infrastructure in. We don't want to buy the pipes that are needed in order to, you know, make the land viable for development. But that mayor, like every mayor in New Zealand and every council in New Zealand, seems to think that growth and development are some kind of, you know, necessity. Because if you have a bigger community, then you have more ratepayers. But it doesn't work that way. The bigger your community, the more infrastructure you need. And infrastructure comes at a long-term cost, whereas adding the rating unit is a short-term thing. So the more rating units you add, the further behind you get on answering your infrastructure needs. Simple as that. And this, you know, Three Waters, when it was proposed by the Labor government, it wanted to purchase those assets from the councils. So the stormwater, the wastewater, and the water reticulation assets. And I remember saying at the time, they're not assets, they're liabilities on council balance sheets. What a wonderful idea. Take the liabilities off of these council balance sheets, let them get on with community, you know, with developing their communities, with putting together programs that help people come together. That's what kind of a council in a local neighborhood ought to do, ought to focus on, not on the core services, because the core services are infrastructure, just like roads, just like, you know. So I thought, what a wonderful opportunity Three Waters was. And then every mayor nearly across New Zealand came out about, they want to steal our assets. And the people came out about, they want to steal our assets. They want to, you know. And the funny thing is, they're not assets. They're liabilities, is what I kept trying to, you know, say to people. These are liabilities. Central government is far more capable. But the problem is local government, I don't know whether you think this is true, Jaspreet, very parochial. You know, what we pay CEOs of local government in New Zealand is embarrassing. It's ridiculous. Over $300,000, I think, per annum. I mean, I don't know about, you know, farmers, but I'm pretty sure that many people who are landowners in New Zealand would love to earn 300 grand a year. You know, the ones that work the land, that go out and milk the cows every morning.
Quite right. Yep.
So this is ridiculous. What are we doing paying CEOs $300,000 a year? And it's only because they have these big balance sheets. You know, they have these massive infrastructure assets under their control. That's why they didn't want to let go of them.
Yeah. Because but
the job description would be a 100K sort of job.
So there must be a model somewhere in the world that is perfect. And sorry, listeners, we have a bit of internet problems here with me today, but there must be somewhere, Catherine, that has the perfect relationship between infrastructure and the community and how you charge for it.
Yes, I've read a lot.
Mm.
Frankly, in many cases, I look overseas and there isn't a model. You have to be innovative. Nothing translates directly to being relevant to New Zealand. I've got a scheme for a way to regulate the rental market, which I'm working with government on at the moment. And they all draw from overseas and they say, whenever you actually try to regulate rents, the people that are in the regulated properties won't move, and it, you know, means the others are subject to market forces and blah, blah, blah. They all come up with, but overseas. My formula idea is tailored to New Zealand conditions, and it's universal, which has never been applied overseas. You know, so I always say we have the brain power here to come up with solutions unique to New Zealand. And given our little population and our very difficult terrain and the distances, I mean, there's more roading, more paved roading per capita population here than anywhere in the world, if
right.
I'm not wrong. I mean, it was the case some years ago. So the overseas solutions aren't, in my mind, they often in the planning profession, Houston is brought up as, look at Houston for development. They have no zoning. They go anywhere they want to. Well, I've been to Houston. It's as flat as a pancake. It's a completely different environment. We've got a microcosm of differing environments here. That's why tourists find us unique. You can drive for 3 hours and see a desert, a mountain, and a beautiful agricultural plain, you know. So we're so very changing that I think we have to think for ourselves.
Yeah,
it's always been quite amusing to me that you, for instance, and you're talking underground pipes for wastewater or stormwater. Yeah, you've got 100,000 people and you're trying to then put 200,000 people in the same area without beefing up the diameter of the pipe. Now, I sort of have a feeling that the first 100,000, they did it all right. They actually had the pipes at the right size. The second 100,000 should have had to find their right size pipe that connects directly to the treatment plant it is, rather than then pushing it through the same old pipes.
Yes.
I mean, it's what we do on farms. You can't push more water down the same size pipe if you've doubled the head. It
yes.
just doesn't work as easily. Unless you're putting it under pressure, it just doesn't work. So it's mysterious to me. I have a different view to you slightly, Catherine. I thought that the councils purposely liked Three Waters because they wanted to do their non-core business and had spent so much money doing non-core business like roads and water that they'd gotten behind so far because they were doing the superfluous stuff, what you might have called the community stuff. Well, in our region here, we have so much money that isn't superfluous stuff, going into superfluous stuff. And to me, they did neglect some of their pipes and roads. So I like the idea of local control. So slightly different to you, yeah, of the water infrastructure. I like the local control of everything, actually. In fact, the brain in me is now saying, I wish we could go back to 1989 and have our small councils, our little, before the Elwood reforms, go right back there because the potholes got filled. There was no economic development agency in little enclaves. There was none of this extra stuff. And those little communities flourished.
Mm. What council are you with?
We're in the Southern District Council, but I'm thinking in the old days, there was many councils in the region. They were called county councils, and they just had their one head office. It was a very small head office, and they had their own trucks, and you would think very inefficient, you would think. But actually, when I think back, we had a great province. It did have its potholes fixed, and it did have an expanded paved, you know, like bitumen or asphalt roading system. And now it just seems all too hard.
Don, and I think there's also the consultants that have come in, you know, like we're speaking, Jacobs that have come in. They're a big international consultant that are doing. None of those were used in council then, from what I understand. And I remember the Three Waters, you know, the whole uproar at that time, Catherine. And for people, many of them had paid for their schemes all this time, the ratepayers, and suddenly they were being taken away without any compensation. But regardless of what's happened, what we are seeing is the new regulator has been appointed, Tamota ROI. It's in place. And it is pushing these gold-plated water standards that communities cannot afford. And along with it, there's been a bit of this whole thing about the manner of the water. And instead of just focusing on what most people want, safe water, we are suddenly going into all sorts of equity and cultural things. And people say, that's a basic amenity of life, for God's sake, just provide that without bringing all of this into it. But yeah, and again, like you, there's no happy medium. I sometimes look at the country and I think, we're just 5 million people. How come we have 70 plus councils and unitary bodies? How exactly is that possible?
Yeah. And each CEO is on more than $300,000 a year.
You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. So, yeah, there's no one right answer here.
Yeah. Which is why, I mean, I'm very pro local. You know, I liked the idea in Invercargill, for example, that local government sponsored free education at the Polytechnic as one of its activities. I think that's beautiful because that's local. That's saying, you know, to other New Zealanders, come down here. We're a community. We're going to provide you with an education because we need more knowledgeable people in our communities. It's a great way to get plumbers and builders and nurses, you know, interested in Southland. So that's the kind of initiative that I like local. I don't see providing the right size pipe being anything that must be made, the decision that must be made locally, nor do I see it as it should be paid for locally, because there's no equity in that, and that there are many smaller communities like your own who can't afford to upgrade this outdated infrastructure. I mean, look, if Wellington City is in such a mess with all the people it has and all the growth it had, it's because pipes rust over time. And the cost of putting them back in or widening them or whatever has become, as you say, no more do we have a Ministry of Works. In other words, you want to dig a hole, you got to hire a contractor. And it's, we can't go back to the way you're hoping, Don, because that would require us to grow government even more.
No, I'm all about efficiency, Catherine. It's interesting to me. I see so much when you drive around the country or fly into Auckland Airport, you see all this metal, these heavy machines sitting idle for days on end. We work 8-hour days. We don't try to have 24-hour shifts and maximize the value out of those machines and the people that drive them. So we're very inefficient compared to other countries who would not worry about the noise and the affection, injurious affection to other people and their sleep patterns and all the rest of it. We just wouldn't worry about that if we were in some other countries. But we do worry about that here, and it comes at great cost, I think.
Yes, to our efficiency overall. Mm. That's a possibility I hadn't really even thought about, but you know, I see plenty of machinery sitting idle as I travel around. I then think, okay, if we're going to run that 24/7, which is a pretty good idea, I mean, I think they did do that on Transmission Gully. That was a 24/7 operation. Probably only in areas where, as you say, the noise wasn't going to be a problem to the neighbors. Noise wouldn't be such a problem to the neighbors if indeed people were double glazed. Makes a huge difference. And again, I would think that that's the kind of thing local government should get involved in, working with its ratepayers to upgrade their, you know, homes, put solar on, become more self-sufficient. Farmers, there's a thing called payment for ecosystem services in the planning, you know, profession. Costa Rica has done it. We should do it here. If I want a bigger wetland margin, which I do, I think we've, you know, closed in on so many of our wetlands, we need to look to the Public Works Act to buy those margins. And it's the same way with our rivers. You know, farmers own land right up to the edge of a river. Why don't we pay them for those ecosystem services? Make it public land.
And then where does private property go, Catherine? And again, for me, it comes down to productivity. That is something we'd be doing anyway. If we start monetizing that, where will that end? I just see job schemes, then compliance regimes, then a whole lot of people with clipboards coming along and ticking off. Meanwhile, the thing that we do best in this country, grows some of the world-class protein, animal protein, we are being penalized for that in the name of climate change. And that's where it comes to. Once you let the government behind the farm gate, where is that going to stop? And for most of us, we just want less government. We want to, you know, get on with our lives, be allowed to do what we do best as farmers. And every possible roadblock that can be put in our way is done. And that's what worries me with all of these things that are coming forth, that once monetization for stuff like that begins, we've seen what happened with the pine trees now blanketing the country. There will be hard to draw a line there.
That should not have been allowed. That private land should have been taken back into public land, and native forests should have been planted.
Yep.
But because it was private land, we allowed a productive crop to go on there that was harmful for the environment. Private property rights are a really interesting thing. I don't believe that farmers in general don't want to plant, you know, the margins of the rivers that run through their properties. Yeah. They do. They just aren't given enough money to do so. And that's where payment for ecosystem services come in. Mm. You know, that's what that whole scheme is about. It's about saying, hey, you own a piece of land. That wetland on your land could be expanded. Let's actually do it together. Let's make that expanded wetland. We're going to compensate you for the land it is that you will no longer be able to graze.
Sure. And so, Catherine, that is one of the standard discussions that we have. And a question line I put to you was this intersection between economic development, economic constraint, where private property fits in, where the use of the productive environment fits with conservation and preservation. And of course, my view in a New Zealand sense is we're the only sort of, well, Australia, New Zealand, but pretty much New Zealand, we don't have production subsidies. And I applauded that at the time in 85 and 1985. And now the issue is this. Consumers don't want to pay more for their food. Farmers actually don't really want to take anything from the taxpayer and say, we want you to come and plant on our private property. We can willing to plant on our own, of our own volition. But you need to leave us with more money in our pockets from our production systems.
That's right.
But then on the other side, you want cheaper food, and there's all these reef fish nibbling at the edges saying you can't make a profit on the farm. So there's a massive contradiction in here. Or is it a contradiction, or is it a political machine that's meddling here? I think with less meddling, this is my view, Catherine, less meddling by the political class, we would actually have farmers do the right thing with their own money, as most of us did, actually. Yeah. Those of us that came through the 80s did. And I do worry about these biodiversity credits and the like being used as a way to effectively, say, become virtuous about it outside the farm gate by the consumers of the world saying, we'll buy these credits and this right to that preservation because we want to feel good about our food purchases. We don't need to do any of that if we actually just had the free market and the open markets working well, which we don't seem to have anymore. But I've put my view and you've put yours. But what is the remedy for all this? Because it's an issue that I've fought in amongst for 30 plus years.
Yeah, I think it comes down to the binary of environment versus economic development. Mm. And you have to get rid of the binary. So for every, according to Jacques Derrida, for every binary oppositional, one side is favored over the other. So what we have to do is triangulate. So it's a methodology, radio spectrum, for example, to find where it is that interference is occurring. And the way to triangulate decision-making is to understand that planning is about three core issues: environment, economy, and equity. And equity is where the public good gets served. So it's not in the public good for our nitrate levels in freshwater to be elevated to a dangerous level, or it's not in the public good for councils to have inadequate water and sewage plants and E. coli to be, you know, released into our environment. So you've got to triangulate this decision-making. Equity or social equity. So it's the three E's: equity, environment, and economy. If you can triangulate decision-making in that way and solve all of the conflicts that are created on those aspects of the triangle. So for example, between equity and environment, it's often an issue of jobs versus environment. People will say, yes, but mining will produce employment. And so we have to sacrifice the environment in favor of employment. So that's the equity part of the triangle. Mm-hmm. Versus the property conflict comes in when it is that you have, you're in the economic realm of farming. And you want to apply fertilizer to your land, yet that fertilizer is going to run off and create higher nitrates in the river. That's a property conflict. Whereas the previous one I mentioned about jobs versus nature is what we call a development conflict.
Mm.
So if we triangulate our environmental problems, and that's not what we do, we just constantly talk about the environment versus the economy. We keep forgetting about this key core principle of democratic governance, and that is equity. We have to think about that as being equally as important as environment versus economy. That's my thought. That's how problems.
Well, absolutely. And it's part of the show's ambit is to try and get all sides of the story. And I don't present a case that's, I defend my corner and you defend yours. And that's how we should have a rational decision, a discussion. And that's what RCR is all about. Look, we're up against time, but there's one last thing that I had on my list to talk to you about. And that is the fast track bill at the moment. And the second point was, this could take hours to get through, but if we can do it relatively quickly, is the RMA. What was wrong with it? I mean, I know what I thought was wrong with it. And mm-hmm. it came back to the fact of there was no compensation for takings for private property. I think that's been an impediment in the RMA from day one. But, you know, so we've got to 2024 and we're going to reform it. We've been trying to reform the RMA probably in little piecemeal ways we did. My entire understanding of this, the last 23 years we've been, 33 years now, we've been trying to say it's not fit for purpose, but here we are 23 years later and we're trying to do something. What was wrong with it? What was right with it? And why is it that you're concerned about, for instance, the fast tracking of ideas now and developments?
What was mainly wrong was councils were not actually skilled in what is what the RMA's intention was, and that was managing externalities. So the idea of the RMA was no zones, you can do whatever you like on your property or build whatever you like on your property as long as you don't actually impact in a negative way your neighbor. And that never worked. We never figured out how to do effects-based management. So that was the problem with the RMA. Lack of training for planners in effects-based management. They didn't transition well from town and country planning. And for example, Town and Country Planning Act, that had standing. So then we ended up with this problem where anybody, you want to do something on your land, and anybody in the nation can put in an objection. What you want to do. It's crazy. So the RMA had no standing, another right. problem. And as a result of having no standing, you get the EDSs of this world, a whole bunch of lawyers. Here's the third problem. RMA was taken over by the legal profession.
Yes.
The planning profession is hardly got anything to do with it at all. They just have to write plans, you know, and the plans, what they have to write, and what they have to look at, are enforced by central government. So planners were very much knocked out of planning almost completely in terms of being decision makers. We're no longer decision makers. You know, we're just administrative. Tick a box, tick the box, tick the box. The central government tells us what boxes we have to tick. And then when we make a decision, all these other people who have nothing to do with it and don't live locally come in and disagree. Mm. And the decisions are made by commissioners who are, you know, appointees. They're not made by, planners. So the RMA was good legislation, but too many lawyers were involved in its development. And as time went on, it became more and more and more and more complicated.
Yeah, and it seemed... All right, and it seems to me... Sorry to interrupt. It seems to me that the precautionary principle was massively overstated in many entities or areas. And, you know, it has been a handbrake on... You may talk about either the triangle, the economic, environmental, and equity. It was a handbrake on all of that, in my opinion. So, Yeah, look, it's interesting. Time will tell what this coalition's going to come up with. But Catherine, we have had a lot of your time, and we haven't perhaps done justice to that last point, but we did a really good justice to the RCP story early on, and we thank you for coming on RCR Greenwashed, because as I said earlier, it is about getting all sides of the story, and we just haven't had it. We just haven't had it. So no, grateful for your input. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine.
You're welcome.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.